92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Aaron Camaro and Chris Sinzak.
All right, time once again to rock and roll with your favorite podcast. Oh yeah, the Decibel Geek Podcast. Coming back at you once again every single week we're here with you. I am Aaron Camaro, joined as always by... So, are you here? Are you not here? Where are you, Chris and Zach?
I'm in two places at the same time.
That's amazing. How do you do that?
I've finally unlocked cloning technology.
Nice. Yeah. So, are you the clone, or... Well, obviously, you're the clone.
We'll leave it a mystery.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, but technically, where at this moment that this is being released, where are you?
I'm probably in the Anaheim Convention Center at the NAMM show.
Nice. Man, you're so lucky.
I know. I don't think I don't know it. But yeah, it's so if you're hearing this on the release, I'm hopefully hobnobbing with people. But otherwise,
and getting videos and setting up future interviews
and getting no sleep
and getting no sleep.
Yeah,
no sleep. LA.
I'm gonna be dead by the time I get home. Probably. It's gonna. I'm honestly trying to figure out when am I going to sleep.
They found him in an alley back on the Sunset Strip somewhere.
I'll look like that chick on the first Guns N' Roses album that was banned. Get raped by LA.
Oh no.
But no, it was. It's a crazy week. So, but at the same time. A very long and much anticipated episode this week.
Yeah, man, this is going to be a lot of fun today. Yeah. You know, before you got here, I was watching my new favorite TV show.
What's that?
The New Celebrity Apprentice.
Oh, I haven't seen any of that.
Vince Neil is kicking ass.
He's not singing.
He is singing. He's been doing some singing. He's been doing some songwriting. He's been doing some fundraising. He just earned big money for his charity, which is like a brain cancer fund kind of thing, you know.
Was that the one that is his daughter in his daughter's name?
I don't think it's in his daughter's name, but he had a friend that recently died.
Oh, really?
Of some sort of brain mishap, I guess. Something went wrong. I don't fully understand it.
So he's like in the lead right now? Or
but yeah, this last challenge that they did, he was the project manager, and he earned buku bucks for that. Like, more than anybody's earned on the show so far. Vince Neil is killing it right now on that.
All right.
I'm loving it.
Well, that's cool.
I watch that show. I cheer for Vince.
My money was on Boy George.
You know, him and Boy George wrote they had to write a jingle together.
Yeah, I saw there was like a teaser for that online a week or so ago.
Yeah.
Showing that Boy George was complaining about Vince getting drunk in the studio. It's like, you've obviously never met Vince Neil before, boy.
Right, yeah. And Vince Neil's basically like, yeah, screw that guy. You know, just because you don't drink doesn't mean you got to push that on everybody else. I like to have a couple of glasses of wine when I'm trying to be creative. But the jingle they came up with, like Trident Gum, were like, we'll buy that.
It was good?
We'll use that tomorrow. It was pretty neat.
I'm going to have to go back and watch it now.
Yeah, but Vince Neil's kicking ass, and as far as it goes right now, he's still in it. I'm cheering for him. It's good. Right. Good stuff.
Representing, is there any old Motley Crue footage or anything on the show?
I haven't seen nothing like that yet. No, yeah. just the current stuff, what's going on. So it's good stuff. You know, yeah, I'm proud of him. He's doing really good.
I picture Swords and I go, I really like that song, Looks That Kill.
Oh man, that's awesome.
It sounded just like him.
Yeah, I thought you were a clone of Schwarzenegger there for a second.
I'm working on that one too.
All right, well, before we get into the rock and roll like we always like to do, you know, and this week is a really special episode and our guest is super awesome. Before we get into that, you know, I got to start this show with a sweet ass 5-star iTunes review. And you guys have been on the case lately. You really haven't let me down. I haven't shed a tear over this in almost a year now.
Yeah, let's keep that streak going.
Yeah, guys. You know, keep me sane, keep me happy, and keep them coming. This one's awesome, and it's entitled New Listener. It comes to us from USMC 171.
Thank you for your service.
Yes, and it goes a little something like this. I just found this podcast today, and I am currently on my fourth episode. I've heard enough to know I'll be digging way back in the episodes. Work flew by today for me. Thanks, guys. Great show so far. We'll be definitely looking forward to hearing more tomorrow.
Sweet.
There you go. Brand new listener.
Love hearing that.
Checking it out for the first time, leaving us that sweet iTunes review. It only took them four episodes to figure it out.
Yeah.
It's awesome. So
yeah, that's a good early adopter.
If you haven't figured it out yet, we really like five-star iTunes reviews. And if you could leave us one, we'll love you forever.
Yeah, and that's a brand new listener. And, you know, a lot of ways we get brand new listeners are because of our Geeks of the Week.
Right. Geeks of the Week are the people that go out the week before. They take last week's episode.
Yep.
They share the heck out of it all over the internet. They get the word out for us. They're talking to their other hard rock and metalhead friends and letting them know about the Decibel Geek podcast. And it grows and it grows and it grows. And it's awesome.
I'm proud of that segue. That was the best one I've had.
That was really good.
All right. So Geeks of the Week this week are Paul Korn, Baco, Cobras and Fire Podcast, Thomas Mukaji, Dave Shirt. He shared it a couple of times.
Good.
Anthony Britt, John Karabi, Italia, Joe Royland, Sit and Spin with Joe, Brad Calmanson, Wally Norton, Wayne Cross, Robert Ross, Andrew Kiss from Podcast Rock City, Mike Grabowski, Rock and Ron Runyon, Cool World, James Brendan Dunn, Dave Koska, Brant Cattell, Warren Money, Kenneth Roy, Mikhail Burrell, Derek Novak, Brian Knapp, Joe Lascon, Kevin Williams, Dan Chapu, Mark Alden Taylor from the Freeform Rock Podcast, Andrew Jacobs, Chad Leesener, Linda Kroll, Ernesto Aguiar, the Off Our Meds Podcast, Graham Spark, Christopher Stokes, and the Mooger Fooger.
Awesome. Those are our people, man. We love them very much. They take the episode, they share it, they retweet it, they help us get the word out. You want to become an honorable Geek of the Week, all you got to do is take this week's episode, share it with everybody you know.
Yep.
Go to our Facebook page, find that original post, comment on it, all that good stuff. Share it, share it, share it.
That's right. So the setup real fast for what you're about to hear.
Ooh, this is going to be awesome,
man. You saw the artwork, you know the title. It's been a long time coming. I've been wanting to do an Albums Unleashed on All Systems Go for a while.
You guys are going to love this.
Bobby Rock was playing in Louisville, Kentucky with Lita Ford, who he's the drummer for now.
Yeah.
And I had been waiting until he was within driving distance to ask him to do this. Because, I mean, Skype and phone calls are cool, but it's even cooler to meet the person in person.
Right. And the interviews, the conversations always, always go better when it's in person. I don't care who you ask.
And this is Albums Unleashed on the album. But it's much more than that. It's more of a discussion of that era of the Vinnie Vincent Invasion. So
right, because Bobby was such a cool guy. It's hard to stick to a format when you're having so much fun, just having an open, free-form, free-flowing conversation. And man, Bobby Rock, that guy's the coolest.
It's a fun talk, and you guys are going to learn some new stuff. Even you diehard Vinnie fans, I think, are going to learn some new stuff.
Because I learned a lot
of new
stuff.
Some of it was definitely new to me.
Yeah? Really?
Yeah.
Even you?
Even me.
Wow, people, we're in for something today.
All right, this is our talk with Bobby Rock on All Systems Go.
Right. That's how you know they're doing their
job. They're doing their job. They're not nervous. They're slacking. There's a little postcard for the show if you want to get that.
Nice.
So you, I'm not sure if you've heard of us or not. We've been around for 5 years, and we kind of consider the podcast for Vinnie Vincent fans. We've done 6 specials on him.
Wow.
On his career with different people that have worked with him. We had Mark Slaughter on last year with us. It was very cool about coming on and talking about that era. And we also do these things called Albums Unleashed, where we'll take one particular album, get a person who was involved with that album, and sort of break go track by track memories of how it was made, circumstances, all that.
Right.
Wanted to see if you would be cool with talking about All Systems Go today.
Sure.
Okay.
Awesome.
And I want to preface this with, if you want the Albums Unleashed on the first Vinnie Vincent Invasion album, read Bobby's blog.
Right.
Because the blog you did on that record was incredible. Like,
ooh,
super detailed.
Yes.
And a lot of Vinnie fans interact with us. So you got lots of praise for being so open on how that was made.
Cool.
Because it was very, very different way of making a record, which I'm, you know.
You might say that, yeah.
At the time, you didn't know, but because you were brand new to that whole experience. But I guess in hindsight, you're probably like, wow, that was much different than what I've done since then. So,
oh, yeah.
But, we wanted to talk about All Systems Go, and because you've covered the first one so well. And first, thank you for coming on and doing this. A lot of fans are going to be happy to hear from you on this.
Yeah, and thanks for the blogs that you did, too. Like Chris said, you know, very well written. The story from your perspective on all that was very amazing, and it really made for a good read.
It did.
Right on.
Yeah, we liked it a lot.
And I've been wanting to get you on the show for about 5 years now, because the goal is eventually, of course, to get every one of you guys on the show, which... We know one will be harder than the others to get. But there has been...
Dana Strum's a busy guy.
Man. Yeah, true. But we've had Mark on, we've had Robert on, and Dana, we want to get Dana too. He's hard to get also. He's not big into doing a lot of interviews and stuff. He's got a lot going on in his life. But thank you for doing this.
Sure.
So, you know, go to the Bobby's blog if you want to hear the details on the first album. So the first album came out, and then you guys toured pretty heavily behind it.
Right.
It was Alice Cooper you opened for on that tour mostly?
Mostly Alice Cooper, and then we did Iron Maiden also.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Before we get into the record, what are your memories of when that Boston show where where Hirsch Gardner put the legal order out to get your equipment taken? What was the story with that?
It was pretty crazy, man. For us, it was... We're out in the left field, you know. I want to say we were at like one of those Strawberries record.
Uh-huh.
So we were doing a signing in the Boston area that day, and we all get back on the bus afterwards. And I think our tour manager came on and said, "Okay, well, they got the drums." He started like talking like we already had a clue of what had already happened.
Yeah,
they managed to save some of the guitars, and we're like, "What the fuck is going on here?" You know, and so that's when we got the lowdown about what happened. At this point, it's late afternoon.
Yeah.
We got to play the set. So we go back over to the venue, and sure enough, all of our shit was gone.
Oh, wow.
And from what I recall, I think he had what was known as something like a writ of attachment or something like that, where anything that had Vinny's name on it, he had
hard ownership.
Legal access to at least confiscating to settle this claim, you know?
Right.
And... So the drum cases, of course, the Vincent Invasion, anything else they were able to find, they grabbed all that shit. Folklore has it, at the day of it, the guitar tech told us that as soon as he saw what was going down, he grabbed Vinny's guitars, brought them in the bathroom into a stall, set them on a toilet, closed the door, and put an out-of-order sign on that stall.
Just to save them.
And that's what supposedly saved Vinny's, custom guitars.
Bill Temple?
Yes.
Yes.
Holy fuck.
I know my stuff, man. And the manager was George Stewart.
Right? That's right.
Yeah.
The tour manager was Todd Cooper, yeah.
Okay.
So, what do? You got to play a show in 2 hours or whatever. So I remember we got some rental gear. We just threw the shit up there real quick.
Wow.
We did three songs. We did Boys Are Gonna Rock, Animal, and Twisted.
Wow.
And the review of the show, it was at Worcester, Mass. Was it the Centrum? Anyway.
I think so, yeah.
It said, Vinny Vincent Invasion played a short but intense set.
Uh-huh.
So it was actually not even a bad review, but...
Oh, okay.
Wow.
So, it was difficult. We had, I think, only a few more shows left. We had a little break. We had more shows, and so the bottom line is we had to use rental gear for my drum company supply. It was a big pain in the ass for weeks, you know.
Well, when that went down, what was Vinny saying about Hirsch?
Well,
he surely had to have been pretty pissed off.
Well,
about
man, we were already about to lynch the motherfucker at that point, because we didn't know his side. We just listened to it. Like Vinny was oh man, from Vinny's perspective, it was all about he was vilifying Hirsch for what had happened, and he had no claim and all that. So we wound up in an attorney's office that night until the wee hours.
Wow,
you know.
Oh,
making
wild.
How we're going to proceed and all that. It was a heavy, heavy thing, you know?
Yeah.
And then, so the gear was just, so we didn't know, it was just somewhere, you know?
Wow.
It was a tough thing. And we even started the Iron Maiden tour with all of this other shit, you know? I say Renegade. I mean, I just got an endorsement with Sonar, so they were cool enough to provide me with another kit, but it wasn't, my kit, you know?
Yeah, and that feels like... So. Completely foreign when it's not what you're used to playing, especially drummers.
Right.
If it's not all the same gear, then you feel like you've lost an appendage or something, I'm sure.
Exactly.
But we had Hirsch on the show to share that story, so we heard it from his end, but I wanted to hear it from a member of the band's end.
And by the way, in retrospect, I mean, that you understand, at that moment, all we knew was Benny's side. And then as I've, as the years have gone by, I understand that, first of all, if he was able to even do that...
Yeah.
He must have had
some,
you know.
Yeah. and then the authorities go along with it.
Right. So I've come to understand that he had a valid perspective. I don't know any of the details of it, but I'm sure. You know, so.
Did you ever talk to him?
I don't think I've ever met him.
Oh, okay. It's weird. We've always interviewed a number of Vinnie Vincent drummers. We've had Hirsch, we've had you, and we had Andre LaBelle.
Oh, cool.
You know Andre.
I just saw Andre last week in Richmond.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Super great guy. Good drummer too.
Mm-hmm.
So that tour ends, and then talk comes to doing another album. Had Mike Bone come on with Chrysalis at that point?
I don't believe he was on board yet.
Not yet?
Yeah.
Okay.
He came a little bit later during the marketing part of it for the release of the record, but not during the recording, I don't think.
Okay. That's interesting because there's, and let me just state that this is speculative on my part, but I've done a lot of homework. There's certain people that have posted on message boards that some people would think that with the knowledge that they put forth that it may be Vinny posing as someone else to explain certain eras from when you guys were together. And one of these people would post that basically Mike Bone was brought on board around that time, and there was a strong push to limit Vinny's solos and make him not sound as wild and crazy and over the top, and to make the album way more radio friendly. And this person, the way they were posting, it sounded like they had an axe to grind with Mike Bone. So I'm thinking if it was him posting that stuff, I'm getting the feeling there was a lot of contention with Vinny and the label higher-ups when that album was being put together.
I believe so. I mean, if Mike Bone was on board then, I don't recall him having the kind of involvement that, for example, Jeff Aldridge, I think, still had, because he was the original A&R guy for the first record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to say he was probably still our guy on board there.
Okay.
You know, a lot of the feedback that we had all gotten about the first record was, you know, kick-ass record, great songs, killer guitar playing, but maybe a little over the top.
Yeah.
You know, so I think we all probably were hoping to sort of dial it back in a bit,
including Vinny.
For the sake of the band, for the sake of what we were, you know, what we were doing.
Yeah.
So, and I remember one time having a really difficult conversation where even right after the conversation, I felt like I was out of line, but what I kind of shared with Vinny, what I, with the sort of consensus, what I felt about, you know, the shit being over the top and almost fatiguing to listen to after a while.
Right.
You know, I realized after I said it, I was probably out of line still, but nonetheless, I thought he played his ass off on the record. I thought, for the most part, it was cool that I know he was upset is on Ashes to Ashes, they cut the shit out of his soul to make it radio, you know. And these edits were so fucking cheesy, man. I mean, it really tore the scrotum off of what he really had originally done, I thought, you know. Yeah. So I understand his point there, but they're trying to get it on the radio.
And I'm a big fan of his playing, and I've come from a guitar player back, not that I could ever play like Vinny, but not that anyone can, but I kind of took his view of it with some of those solos, because there's other releases of All Systems Go where you hear the full solos, you know, not the radio cutdowns. And from a guitar player's perspective, it's like, okay, I wrote a story with a beginning, a middle, of, and
that's
an
exactly
end,
right, yeah.
And you tore the middle right
that's
out
exactly
of the
right,
damn
yeah.
thing,
yeah.
Yeah. Exactly which is probably
right.
where he was coming from.
Right,
it's like, I'm trying to tell a story with this, and you're just shortening it down for radio.
Right.
You know, so
by the way, the bottom line answer to your question there is
going
to be Dana Strum, because he was, no matter where the heat was coming from, everything always filtered through Dana, because Dana is the one who had to sit next to Vinny and record.
Right.
So Dana would be the one to try to get out of Vinny, you know, the happy medium between what Vinny wanted and then what the suits wanted, you know. So he would be able to tell you what the tipping point would have been there. But I think. Honestly, I think in editing, I mean, I don't think Vinny would have, I don't recall him saying, okay, I hate the way the solo is, but because the record company wants to play that one, that wouldn't be his vibe.
No.
You know, so, it would be about the mix, it would be about the edits, it'd be more about the after-the-fact shit, and Bone could have been involved with some of that stuff.
That's what I'm wondering.
Know, towards the end there, you know.
Yeah.
And the final phase of mixing and getting ready to promote and all that, you know.
Was George Tutko working on this, or was it just the first one that he
Tutko was the first one, as far as I recall, yeah. And he just was about the mixing of it, I think, right?
Yeah.
Great. Drag, man, yeah.
Great sound guy.
Yeah.
was the recording, and I have some friends on a Vinnie Vincent fan forum. There's a big one that actually has a lot of members.
Right.
And these people very much obsess over this stuff, so you can help get some of this minutia worked out. Was the recording process for this just as anal as the first one?
Hell no. Not by a mile.
Okay.
Hell no.
So it was a lot looser.
It was not anywhere near the catastrophe. I mean, I think, I want to say 3-4 days.
Yeah.
Bass and drums, Dana and I recorded together,
mm-hmm.
and then did fix-its and all that after each take.
Yeah.
It was a whole different world.
Right.
Do you think that's a result of learning the process in the first one?
Of all that money that was spent and all the work and all that. I mean, it was just, I'm sure it was.
So you weren't being asked to replicate drum machines on this?
No, it was... you know, as I mentioned, I think the first record, you know, and for the record, I'll say again, I don't think Vinny had any kind of power trip. I don't think he mm-hmm. was trying to be an ad. I don't think, you know, I don't think it was anything about that. I just think he was conflicted between loving the live drummer, virtuoso, super chops mm-hmm. vibe,
yeah,
but also loving contemporary music, yeah. even, you know, fucking Billy Ocean and Michael Jackson.
Yeah, he was a pop man, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That has all machines.
Yeah.
So you like that groove and that, you know, the real polished... And everything was machines back then.
Very much. Yeah.
And it was
Miami Vice was machines. Yeah. Everything was machines.
That's what was in vogue.
So I think he was trying to reconcile, okay, well, I want Bobby to go off and do his thing, but then I want that real mechanical thing, you know. So
that's hard to pull off.
Yeah, it's impossible virtually, you know.
Yeah.
And the Def Leppard thing was brand new then. I mean, it was just, you know. So I think by the time we got to the second record, he realized, okay, it's not going to happen. We got to go more for, you know, keep the, I mean, he always liked that real straight up mechanical type of mm-hmm. solid groove, but he liked some chops in there as we had on the record. He liked some of the,
he's kind of two minds making the record, which makes your job much harder.
Yeah.
Okay. His solos with, well, I talked about that. Was there more than the three different solos on the album versions? Because there's two alternate Ashes to Ashes solos in that time of year. And that time of year on that Metal Tech instructional video that he did seems to be an entirely different recording. I don't know if you know any about this stuff.
If he was playing on the tracks, he could have just played winged it on at the moment there. Yeah, which is probably what happened.
That's what I'm thinking. Now, on the beginning of Ashes to Ashes, there's this Memories of You thing that's played backwards.
Right.
And from what I gather, this was a Japanese band that Dana was recording that wound up getting put on there backwards.
It was a Japanese Guitar Hero guy named Kuni.
Uh-huh.
And I actually played drums on the record.
You did?
Because Dana was producing it, and the guy he had wasn't working out, so they pulled me in at the last minute. I had to do the whole record in one day.
Oh, wow. Shit.
And it was a day and a night, believe me. It was almost a 24-hour session. And then Mike Tirana ended up joining the band,
mm-hmm.
and they just, you know, it was kind of an agreement. I was like the ghost drummer, you know, he's the drummer. They didn't mention I played. I don't think they even credited me on the record, but at any rate, that was this sort of elaborate, you know, introduction piece that Dana had just recorded on the Kuni record.
Yeah.
And I think they were in the studio fucking around or something, and he ran it backwards and was like... Oh, wow, let's use this as
the intro. Was Vinny upset about that?
No, I think he was cool. I think, if I recall, what Vinny got upset about was when people played it backwards and heard that it was Memories of You or whatever,
mm-hmm.
Dana made up a story, or somebody made up a story, it must have been Dana, because Vinny got pissed about it, about how it was... it was a tribute or in memory of like a fucking relative or something of Vinny's that had passed away, like a niece or a, mm-hmm. I forget, you know, somebody, I want to say it was a young girl who had died.
Really?
And so as a tribute to her, you know, Memories of You played backwards, da, 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 and, you know, rightfully so.
Yeah.
Vinny got a little perturbed about that.
Yeah, I can understand. You know, like,
do we have to go there with this thing?
You know? I mean, you could turn it into a legend, but let's not place any curses or anything. I can totally understand that.
Okay. So, of course, this was Mark's debut with the band on tape or whatever.
Right.
You know, this has been a thing that goes back and forth with, and just from Vinny's mouth alone, with his feelings towards Mark. At the time, there was the story going around, you know, and Robert's been on our show, and he explained his side of this with, you know, George came to him with this giant contract at the last minute, goes, please sign this. I've already told them you're doing it. And Robert's like, well, I'm not doing it if you're going to be this way. And he leaves, leaving George holding the bag, and then they come up with this story about spending $25,000 on phone calls to get this tape that Mark dropped. And it's very dramatic.
I just got to tell you, hold on. Every time I would hear that, the four of us would be lined up someplace, like on MTV or on some interview or on a radio station, and Mark and Dana, Vinny and Dana would be bantering back and forth about, you know, the girlfriend who sent the thing with her return address, and he cost me. Mark and I would just cringe every fucking time we heard that, man. Anyways, go ahead.
No, it's just, well, so, you know, and it, which at the time, you can't blame them for doing it. You have to do PR and you have to make everything look rosy and the band's a family and blah, blah, blah. We all live in the same house and all that shit. Kiss did it too.
Oh, yeah.
But
they invented it, probably.
And they taught Vinny, I'm sure. Yeah. But they, you know, that story went around. But then over the years, then a few years ago, Vinny started making posts online and saying, you know, I wish we had never done Al Systems Go with Mark. It should have been Robert the whole time. I want to get Robert back and re-record the album. And what did he think of Mark? I mean, was it a last-ditch effort? We need a singer and this guy fits the bill? Or did he really, you know, back that horse?
It was both. Yeah. You know, the when Mark jumped on board, the Boys Are Gonna Rock video was the first time that Mark Slaughter performed on a stage with a band as a front man without his guitar.
Yeah, because he was usually a guitar player.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you see that video, that's the first. Now, there was no dress rehearsal. There was no. That was the first time that Mark Slaughter, you know, performed. And then, you know, our first show opening for Alice Cooper some weeks later, whenever it was, that was his first time as a front man. But of course, he had experience as a singer.
Mm-hmm.
So the VVI tour and even the maiden part of, or the Alice tour and even the maiden part of it was rough. I'm sure Mark probably told you. I mean, there was, I think Vinny was probably largely unhappy with certain things about Mark's singing and would unfortunately share that with him sometimes right before we'd go on stage.
That's not a morale booster.
Which I remember specifically Baton Rouge or someplace in Louisiana, an arena. We're literally waiting for the lights to go down so we can walk on stage. And Vinny, I remember, said something very cutting to him about how he needed to get his shit together and start singing better if he wanted to be on the next record.
Oh, wow.
Then the lights go out. It's like, what the?
Good luck.
Dang.
So, and that, by the way, speaks to not Vinny being an asshole, per se, but just not having that big picture.
Forethought.
The understanding, the depth of understanding that, listen, I need to have this conversation after the show.
From doing these shows about Vinnie Vincent, one thing I've always picked up is how many times do you think Gene and Paul did that to Vinnie right at that moment before he went on stage?
Exactly.
He mimicked what he learned, I'm sure.
So, but I'll tell you, I remember very specifically summer of 87, Mark and I were rooming together at the time, having a blast. Vinny was writing the tunes, we were getting everything ready to go, and then what happened is Mark would go to Vinny's house to do the demos for the record. It was cool.
Yeah.
I don't remember there being any real issue. I thought, you know, we all thought Mark sounded great on the shit. I don't remember Vinny second guessing it. Should we get somebody else? Should we look up Robert? Mm-hmm. I remember it all felt like it came together that summer. You know, it was nice. It was light and easy and fun.
Yeah.
And Mark was, he felt comfortable, as I recall, you know, recording. Mm-hmm. Everything was cool. Went in the studio. And I don't have any memories of, like, a lot of Mark necessarily being put through the ringer in an unnecessary way, you know, per se. So I think at that point, you know, if Vinny now says, well, I didn't, you know, maybe he just kind of, you know, talked himself, you know, came to peace with it or whatever then, but I don't recall there ever being a real issue or any other discussion about anybody else doing it, you know?
Well, I guess anyone, you talk to someone 20, 30 years later, they're going to have different thoughts on stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I certainly don't feel the same way about a lot of stuff I did 30 years ago. were you getting a lot of different offers from equipment guys? Why Sonar at the time?
Well, I was just at the point of starting to talk to a couple different drum companies and you know, see what options were. Back then, it was all about, you know, who you were with, what was going on, the record coming out, the potential tour. It was all kind of built on what kind of visibility you could bring to the drum company. Obviously, I guess that's still that way to this day. So I remember I'd been in talks with Pearl, and that's why there's a Pearl drum kit in the Boys Are Gonna Rock video. You know, we were getting friendly with Pearl. I was talking to a couple other, you know, not every manufacturer was jumping. I think I was looking at Paiste cymbals. Mm-hmm. Just kind of making the connections, and Dana was involved. He was helping, you know, and so forth. And then Tommy Lee left Sonar for Pearl.
Oh, okay.
And a big ass hole opened up over there at Sonar.
Yeah.
And Sonar and Sabian cymbals were kind of connected. And I had heard Sabian, I liked him, but I hadn't really played him much, you know. And then all of a sudden, through another friend who made a connection, blah, 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 next thing you know, the doors in the Sonar castle opened. And Sonar has always been like, you know, the Rolls Royce of the drum world, like the most expensive, the biggest, the baddest, the coolest, you know, kind of thing. Not necessarily the most popular, but you know what I mean. So it was just, you know, they made me an offer I couldn't refuse, you know. Yeah. It was kind of a tied in. They had, like I said, the same distributor, so it was Sabian and Sonar, you know, cymbals and drums together. I mean, it was like Christmas morning up in this motherfucker when they sent all the gear to SIR for rehearsal, you know.
Yeah, it was like, what a great day, right?
And Pearl, you know, I didn't have a form. You know, we were just still kind of talking, and I'll tell you what, we'll provide you with a kit for the video. And it was just one of those things, man, where, you know, I it's a business thing. I had to make the move. I'll never forget the answering machine message I came home to from the artist relations guy at Pearl. You know, Bobby, what has happened? I'll never forget that. Ringing in my ears 30 years later, you know. But that's how that went down. I loved it. I mean, the drums are great. Sabian, I'm still on board with Sabian. You know, it's been over 30 years now that I've been playing about right at 30 years, actually.
Gotcha. Right. Were there any additional players on the album? Because Philip Wolf from Impellitteri has mentioned that he was on the record.
On the second record?
Yeah, on All Systems Go.
What does he do?
I just know he's an Impellitteri. This is a question from someone else. So.
I don't recall anybody else. I mean, there could have been some background. There could have been some people coming in to sing, probably, on background vocal day. I honestly don't have any recollection of anybody else but the four of us playing on the shit, you know?
So what was the recording environment like? Like you said, it wasn't as anal and nutty as the first one. I mean, but was everyone getting along pretty well at this point?
Yeah, it was cool. You know, drums at Baby-O again. Mm-hmm. Drums in the big room downstairs. I don't think we had as much. I don't think it was as elaborate with all the extra PA and all of that, you know, but it was still, you know.
Centerfolds all over the...
That was upstairs, yeah. That was over at Cherokee. So we did drums at Baby-O, and then I believe we wound up. I know we wound up at Cherokee, but I don't remember how soon we got over there. I don't know if we did. I know we did drums and bass at Baby-O, and maybe guitars. But then again, guitars could have been at Cherokee, but everything wound up at Cherokee, basically. Gotcha. You know.
I want to bring this up because we've had Rick Fox on the show before.
Yeah.
You probably know him from the LA scene.
Right, right.
Was played with Wasp for a little while too. He and I've A-B'd this on YouTube, and Mark has also been pretty open about it. There was a song that he was in a band called Sin at the time, and around the time this was being tracked.
Yeah, Dana produced, right?
Yep. And that's where I'm going. There was a song he did called On the Run, and the riff, basically, if you A-B it on YouTube, it's basically Let Freedom Rock. It's almost identical. Mark basically fessed up to it in the interview we did with him. He said he remembered Vinny and Dana coming back from a tracking session going, oh, we found this awesome riff and we're going to turn this into a song. And Rick ended up suing Vinny over it. And of course, that got wiped out with the bankruptcy in 89. I just don't know if you remember hearing anything about this when it was brought in.
I remember something about that after the fact.
Yeah.
And I want to say it was... I want to say maybe we ran into Rick someplace. Like it was either like for the release party of All Systems Go, or maybe we were just hanging out at a club and something like that. Mm-hmm. I remember you know, running into Rick and him saying, did you know that song? And at the time, I didn't, I wasn't around, I guess, when they told Mark or whatever. I didn't know of the connection of that riff there.
Yeah.
So I heard about it after the fact.
Yeah.
And at some point, I did hear...
You heard the original.
The riff,
yeah. And it's the same riff.
What are you going to say?
Right, yeah.
What are you going to say? It's a coincidence, you know, that Dana produced a band, but Vinny came up with the riff that was, you know, just 50% of the same, you know.
It
happens a lot, you know. One person wanted to know how it's kind of unusual that two ballads made it as music videos from the album rather than any of the like the rocker songs. Was that strategic? Or I mean, because I always thought there would have been a video for Ashes to Ashes.
Right.
Yeah.
Here's the story. Mm-hmm. Everybody, okay, with both of the records, there was always a huge mega hit that one song was kind of modeled after. So if you go to the first record, No Substitute, if you play it back to back with Photograph,
that's the best.
You'll see a lot of similarities. Tempo and the chorus and all those kind of things.
Yeah, I can hear that.
And then between records, Whitesnake comes out. You know, Still of the Night, that kind of vibe, the Zeppelin-y thing. Yeah, yeah. So that was the whole impetus behind
Ashes to Ashes.
Yeah. So, man, everything was about to blow up with Ashes to Ashes going to radio.
Yeah.
Everybody stoked about it. The first single, first video, everything was all set and ready to go.
Yeah.
And then one day, just weeks out, we walk into the Chrysalis office and our radio promo guy, I mean, it was like there was a death, you know, it was like a fucking morgue at the label. We're like, what's going on? Oh, you're not going to fucking believe this, man. This new band has come up with a song called, who's our boy? Just jumped out of my head. James Kotak played drums. You know, the Lenny Wolf. Kingdom Come.
Yeah, Kingdom Come.
And Let It Roll. You know that song? Their first single.
I know what song you're talking about. Yeah.
Let It Something or Other. Or
Get It On.
Get It On.
Yeah.
Real Zeppelin vibe to it.
This was it. This blew the fuck up at radio. And essentially...
You felt like you were replaced.
That was it. They couldn't... At that point, it was over. That was the sort of Whitesnake Zeppelin-y follow-up that radio was going to play.
You're going to feel like a copycat if you do it.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
So at that point...
Wow.
Ashes to Ashes was just a token, you know,
that's
just
kind of
throw it out there, token, you know, 12-inch, whatever release, just get it out there. But we're not going to put a video, we're not going to invest a lot of time and energy because we're not going to be able to get the kind of blast out of radio that we thought we were because of Kingdom Come, basically.
Damn.
So then they said, well, what's our next, like, most commercial song to go with? And then there's, you know, that time of year.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the main reason for Love Kills was, of course, the movie connection.
Yeah.
You know, had the movie not come along, I don't know if they would have went that deep, you know, that deep on the record.
One thing I'm good about that with the whole Nightmare on Elm Street thing is the song was, like, initially pitched to you, or you the movie people pitched it, like, this would be the song for the movie, and there was a video, but... When you watch the movie, it's just playing on a jukebox.
Right, one little scene. Yeah.
Was there bigger plans for it than that?
I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I'm
I guess that's sure more of a record company decision.
Right.
The radio guy you mentioned, would that be Tom Silver?
No, it was Jeff. And I tell you, I'm a little sleep deprived from the last couple of days, so things that I would normally be sharp on, I'm not right now.
I thought you remembered everything from 30 years ago.
Yeah, normally I would, I'm telling you. Forget his name. Jeff somebody.
I interviewed Tom a couple of years ago.
Okay.
But yeah, he had good memories working with all of you guys, but Vinny.
Right.
He ended up working with Slaughter after the fact. So he was there for the whole transition.
Right, right.
And I did didn't interview Mike Bone, but I messaged with him at the time because I was like, I had just talked to Tom Silver and he said a few things that were interesting. And Mike's response essentially was, well, look where Slaughter went, look where Vinny went, we'll just leave it at that. I was like, I don't need to interview to tell you that. A lot of questions, because, you know, the band ended acrimoniously during the tour for this record, but a lot of questions about, you know, was the vibe bad in the studio? It sounds like things up until the road started were pretty good.
Right.
So were there... any plans for other tours for the album aside from the ones you guys did do?
We were looking at a 16-week theater tour with Michael Schenker at one point. Mm. So that was one thing I remember that was on the table.
Yeah.
But they couldn't make the dough work. It was going to take too much tour support to cover the shortfall of what the tour was going to earn and that kind of thing. other than that, I don't recall there being a lot of options.
Right. You know?
I just think we put it together, and at that point, you know, you guys probably, Vinny had walked in with a new manager.
Nigel.
Yeah. And so I think it became kind of a money grab at that point. You know,
yeah.
Our impression was, okay, let's get as much as we can out of merch. Let's get as much as we can out of the clubs. Mm. Let's pay these guys as little as possible. You know, and it kind of became this cycle of let's get out and work and make a bunch of dough. And, that was kind of like, I think, his MO that, of course, we didn't know at the time, but, you know, how it kind of worked out.
Was that different with Nigel's managerial style to George's?
It was night and day. I mean, it was night and day. The pattern that we kind of discovered at some point that Nigel would do is he'd come into the States and he would, you know, manage a handful of different bands and get all of these deals and all of these advances and like commission the fuck out of everything, get a big pile of money. And then at some point, for whatever reason, he would go back to England. He'd kind of bail out, let the smoke, let the dust settle, and then come back in, get a bunch of, you know, do that all over again.
Rape and pillage and then leave town.
That's kind of the impression I got. Now, he's no longer with us, so I don't want to hammer that too much. One of the interesting things, after it was decided that George wasn't going to be around, is that we interviewed a bunch of managers as a band. We'd go sit with them, have dinner with them, all that. All different guys. I grew up, you know, Butch Stone, who did Black of Arkansas. Yeah, all these, you know. We're sitting across from all these guys. It was interesting to kind of see how they handled themselves, what they said they would do for the record. It's like, you know, to be had that vantage point.
Right.
And I got to tell you, man, everybody, this Nigel Thomas, he was the slickest, coolest, calmest, you know, cigarette. And all of his answers were different than everybody else's.
Yeah.
What he would try to do, you know, like there's always this thing to get Vinny more... Yeah, I think Dana was always trying to push Vinny into more of the wild, crazy rock and roll guy. You know, what can we do? And all the managers would kind of conspire. Yeah, we need to get Vinny. And that wasn't who Vinny was.
Yeah.
You know, he was married with two kids.
Right.
He was kind of introverted.
Yeah.
You know.
Not a very
Nigel's like, that's ridiculous. Well, you know, he needs to be more like a Ritchie Blackmore type thing.
That's how
you can't hardly see him.
That's way
there he was.
Accurate.
He just they hustle him in and out secretly, and nobody gets to talk to him or see him. And that was a more reasonable strategy based on, you know, so there was all kinds of things like that he would say and come up with. It's just that at some point, everything kind of shifted and where we all thought we were jumping into like a one for all for one with a new manager is basically Nigel and Vinny. And then it was the cotton pickers, slaving over here, you know, with kind of taking what we could get kind of thing.
And did that situation kind of lend itself to the separation between the members of the band and Vinny?
Oh, I mean, it polarized it, but it was already polarized.
Yeah.
That was the thing. I don't know how much of this is even public at this point regarding that, but the shit hit the fan around that time of year video, around that time when we were shooting the video before we hit the road, where Vinny got wind that there was some sort of behind-the-scenes conversations happening with different management people. Like, we would have a group meeting with the manager, and then Dana might have another meeting with the guy to say, listen, so Vinny is a little whacked out here. And he wasn't trying to... He was just, you know... He was just trying to put all the cards on the table, basically. I don't think his intentions were bad, but it was kind of behind Vinny's back.
From Vinny's viewpoint,
right.
Look what they're doing to me,
So... The way that Vinny sort of received the info is that his band was sort of conspiring against him and was even saying, look, Chris, you know, we'll do another record without Vinny, which, of course, wound up being Slaughter, you know.
Right.
So as soon as Vinny kind of caught wind of all that, and it was sort of confirmed once we hit the road, then it all shifted.
Yeah.
And poolside, St. Louis, Missouri, Bobby Rock and all of his fucking naivete... You know, is the one who had a heart-to-heart with Vinny about that. Because Vinny still wasn't sure what happened.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what, let me just level with the guy and say, listen, man, there was no ill will intended here, but, you know, here, these are some of the challenges we had, and these are some of the conversations we had, and all that.
Right.
I should have never done it. It was a stupid fucking hayseed kid from Houston thinking that I was going to have a heart-to-heart with somebody who would go, you know, we're going to hug and everything's going to go back to normal. It wasn't my place to do it. And everything went south from that day forward. From that day forward, it became this thing where instead of all of us having our own rooms, he was always trying to get me and Mark. He was trying to, you know, like everything became, how can we save money? How can we do, like the whole thing became unbearable. I don't even know if Mark and Dana, if I ever even told them that shit, you know, that I kind of helped along with.
I don't know if he told us that, but I mean, Mark was pretty forthcoming about basically once you guys got on the road for that record, he's like, the band was kind of already over with by the time you guys even started touring for it. Because of these talks.
Right.
He mentioned the Vinny, you know, feeling that people were talking behind his back, and Tom Silver confirmed it too. He's like, because the Chrysalis people were like at their wits' end with some of his behavior. And like, it's way easier to work with the rest of these guys than it is with him. So we're gonna back Mark Slaughter and make him the focus.
Right. And early on in the tour, when we got a first cut, we were playing in San Francisco early on, and they sent us a VHS tape to watch on the bus of that time of year.
Yeah, Mark told us about
that. That had Mark over there, and that was an uncomfortable moment to watch that video together, and for Vinny to see how much he was edited out and Mark was edited out.
Oh, and the byline featuring Mark Slaughter.
Yeah, so that's that all kind of set the tone.
A nail in the coffin right there.
Yeah, that all kind of set the tone as well, all those things.
So would he just have outbursts at you guys?
You know,
or did he just separate himself?
Separated himself. You know, everybody always said, you know, Vinny Vincent's an asshole. You know, actually, I don't think I've ever heard the guy raise his voice even. You know, he wasn't that kind of, and you know, also in his defense, everything he did, there was a reason behind. Like, you know, the hell I went through doing the first record, there was a reason. He wasn't just, and the way he was on that second tour, as unjust as it was and all the shit that we went through and how fucked up the vibe was and all that, it was because he felt a certain way.
Yeah, it sounds like he was coming from a hurt place.
Right. Yeah. So it wasn't like he's just this erratic, nutcase who was,
I don't think so.
Yeah. So in his defense, now look, was there a better way to handle it? Could we have said, sure, but that's just kind of the way it unfolded.
Well, also the music industry was not known for having a ton of level-headedness going on, especially in the 1980s.
Right.
It was a crazy time. It's like the Wild West.
For sure.
Especially you're out on the road. That's not a normal lifestyle.
Right.
So everything gets microscopically looked at and overthought.
Yeah.
And so, I'm sure it was had to have been a very difficult tour
almost unbearable. In fact, the fact that he separated himself, that's what made it work, because sometimes we wouldn't see Vinny all day until literally moments. Like we'd get to we'd travel back and forth between the hotel and the venue separate a lot of times.
Yeah.
We'd get there, we'd hear him warming up.
Yeah.
Minutes before we hit the stage, Vinny would come out with his guitar on, cordial, hey, what's up, guys? Hey, what's up? You know, just cordial. We'd get on stage, do our thing.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, you know, if we wanted to hang out, the bus was leaving at 15 minutes after the set with Vinny to the hotel. If we wanted to go, cool. If not, we could find our own way back.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of times we would find our own, we'd be mingling, and, it was the 80s. We wanted to hang out. And so we'd have to find our own way back to the hotel a lot of times, but that was kind of the way it was. And
just kind of an understanding.
Yeah. Yep.
This is how it's going to happen if we want to keep this show on the road.
That's right.
Wow.
Didn't you guys do some touring with LA Guns on that tour?
Early on, the first handful of shows.
Yeah.
I don't know if they thought it was a co-headlining thing. Our impression was that we were headlining because they were always opening.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a dispute over the drums, the drum riser, use of the drum riser. And it's, tradition that the headliner sets up sound checks and the drums stay put.
Sure.
And whoever opening has to set the shit up in front. Mm-hmm. It's just the way it is. Yeah. So after the first few shows, and sometimes you could, you could roll another riser if there's the venue, but a lot of these venues were smaller where we didn't have the ability to do that. Yeah. So I think they really wanted us to strike the drums, put their shit up there. But then you have the issue where now you're taking an extra on between set. You got to completely put the headliner's kit back up there, mic everything. It's not really practical.
Right.
So our crews kind of became the two different crews, road crews became at odds over this thing. And I don't know, after the third or fourth show or something like that, man, they were suddenly just gone. It just, we couldn't move. I hated that that it kind of came to that. I was always cool with Riley through the years.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, man, we just did a show in England with them, with Lita, and we were at a venue, and it was a similar situation. Lita was headlining, they were playing there. Going into the venue, I told the tour manager, let the motherfucker just play my drums. I told him, something happened 30 years ago. just let the motherfucker play my kid.
Awesome.
You know?
And he did.
He did. Yeah. And his check was there, and usually when you do that, you know, you'll adjust a couple things and go, okay, this is not, you know, it's better that I can just play the headliner's kit a little uncomfortably than set up my own thing in front or whatever like that. But they made themselves comfortable. They, you know, pulled shit out the kick drum and readjusted cymbals and all that, you know. But it was good. His tech was really cool about putting everything back. They were super cool. And I've been always cool with Steve through the years as well.
Did he get a good laugh out of that?
I don't know if he even remembered. We didn't talk about it. I just wanted to make it a point just for the principle.
It's a great way. Riding a raw cool.
Yeah, you know what, man? Just let him play the shit. And we've always been cool. He's a really, really cool guy, as you guys probably know. So
On the album, were there any outtakes or good tunes that didn't make the album that you remember?
Nope. I don't recall any outtakes, and I do recall that Dirty Rhythm was an afterthought. That was the one that was kind of pulled in as like a little jam thing, you know, that we just put together almost on the spot. I mean, it was Benny's riff and all that, as usual. But that was, so instead of having things that we, now maybe there's a couple of things that we never heard that Benny wrote, you know, but whatever he brought to us that Mark demoed went on the record.
So, that leads me into, let's just do the track by track real quick.
Right.
Ashes to Ashes, which we've already talked about pretty heavily here.
Right.
Do you remember the first time you heard the riff for that?
I remember the demo, man.
I'm bummed that it wasn't pushed as a single. Even I understand the justification for why not, but damn, what a song. I mean, that one of the best riffs that Vinny in his whole career, in my opinion, ever wrote.
We heard that shit, and then Mark's demo vocal on it, man. It was like, you know.
It's a powerful song.
Yeah, it's badass.
Yeah, and I love that it has that Zeppelin-y vibe, because you weren't getting a lot of that at that time in music.
Right.
No, and hearing Vinny do it, you know, in his guitar style and his tone on a song like that, that really made it special. And I think it sucks that Get It On, you know, with its Zeppelin-y vibe, screwed all that up, because it was such a strong song, man. It could have changed the whole trajectory of everything.
That's exactly right. And you know, and who knows? I mean, obviously, they threw it out there.
Yeah.
They did throw it out there. But who knows if they would have really got behind it and did a video and all that. Would it have been outright rejected because of Kingdom Come? We'll never know. Mm-hmm. But that was what they said. There's already one out there. There's already a kind of a copycat Zeppelin thing. We can't go there. So it's unfortunate.
Damn record company thinking.
That's stupid. You know, it's like, oh, we can't have more than one song at the same time that's got the same kind of sort of vibe. I mean, that makes no sense.
So you mentioned Dirty Rhythm being an afterthought. So that came in very late to the album.
I mean, at the studio, as I recall.
Yeah.
You know, and we kind of jammed around, we were fucking around with it, and it just became this thing, you know.
Yeah.
To hear that story with that, because that's another really great song that, you know, by just listening to it and knowing it, you wouldn't think that that song was an afterthought. So right, we right. came together right.
So yeah. most of this was written pre-production.
Oh, yeah, yeah. yeah. Vinny, he went off. He has his own way. You know, a lot of times he'll use an acoustic guitar
yeah.
for this stuff.
And, yeah.
Very song-oriented. So he, you know, did all the writing, put all the tunes together. And you know, Dana, he has a lot of influence. I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know, he'll do to alter little things about the riffs or suggest for arrangements and all mm-hmm. that. He has more to do with it than
yeah
one might think.
Well, and that's an interesting thing to talk about because, you know, Vinny is considered like this kind of power mad guy and never like a mad scientist and everything. And he's not going to listen to anybody. But it seems like Dana had quite a bit of influence over production decisions on this stuff.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, Vinny would, you know, if he felt really strong about something, he always had the last word. But and even for the solos and all that, I mean, you know, as I mentioned on the blog about the first record, it was just there was those two guys in a room, mm-hmm. and you know how they would punch on the 2-inch tape, you know, punch in, punch out. I mean, mm-hmm. Dana was really skilled at that, man. Yeah. He could get in and out quickly, and so basically whatever Vinny heard in his head. That punch me in right there between those two little, you know, right. and he could get in and out of this. So that I think influenced ultimately, you know, what Vinny would play to some degree. You know, he had no limitations basically.
Sure, when you have somebody with that skill at your disposal, I mean, the creation ability is unlimited.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially when you got the skills in your fingers and your brain as Vinny Vincent does.
Well, I think what Robert had told us, he was talking about the first album, of course, but about just the way that Vinny would make records at the time. You know, it's basically the equivalent of an artist with a blank canvas and 30 cans of paint just throwing the paint at the canvas. Yeah. He's like, that's the way those records were made.
That's pretty accurate.
Let's just go as insane as we can with this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I hear that a lot more on the first one than the second.
Yeah, I do
the
too. Second the first one's
a little more contained.
Right.
The first one's kind of reckless almost on certain things, but which is what I love about it because it's just, it's been like the end of Animal. I mean, oh my God, you know,
yeah.
especially where, you know, he goes into that extended outro solo and then you all come back. Yeah. Not that we're talking about the first album, but then Love Kills, which is, you know, commercially one of the better songs of that era. And I know it got relegated to a movie soundtrack thing, but of course that was a franchise you're happy to be latched to at that time because it was as big as it ever
was. That's exactly right. Yeah. And that was the big springboard for that song because it wasn't just about radio, just trying to get on radio. I mean, that was a big vehicle for it, you know?
Yeah, and rock bands and horror movies were very synonymous.
I remember thinking how cool that was. Here's this band I really, really like, and it's involved in this movie franchise that I also really enjoy at that time. That was very cool.
I remember MTV doing a special on the movie, and Vinny's wearing Freddie's sweater and his hat and everything. Yeah, that was the first time I remember ever seeing Vinnie Vincent on TV, actually. Was when that MTV special came out.
And then were you shocked the next time you saw him, huh? Boy, pink hair and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Dressed like Freddy Krueger.
But Love Kills, the solo on that song, just incredible.
Yeah.
You come from a drummer's perspective, but I mean, you've played around a lot of guitar players. So, you know, where does he rank for you as far as, you know, what you would watch when he would play back in those days?
I mean, he's one of the baddest there is. Yeah. I mean, you just can't compare him to anybody else. Mm-hmm. He doesn't sound like anybody else. I don't think anybody can mimic what he does. Mm-hmm. In that way, he's extremely unique, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, you know the deal with some of his
the chicken picking.
Yeah, and how he would so he'd have his picking finger, but then he'd have these other two fingers doing the shit in there. And
it's nuts.
We always would whenever we'd rehearse for a tour or for any time for that matter, he and I would always wind up in the room first, and we would just, he would just have me do some kind of crazy double bass thing, and he would just wail.
Yeah.
And as long as I could keep that shit up, he was happy to just sit there and wail. You know?
He'd go forever.
So I have a lot of memory, and we'd, you know, play off of each other, and just hearing him do that shit, man, it was really mind-boggling.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and I'll, well, and then Love Kills is one of the more controlled solos that
right,
he did.
Right, right, right,
and Mark shared with us that, you know, he would call it his Boston solo.
Right, 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 yeah. Right.
It's very similar to what Tom Scholz would have played for Boston. Which, I, you know, until Mark said that, I was like, I never would have guessed that. Right. But when you think about it, it totally sounds like something Boston would have done at the time.
And one thing I think I've probably written about, but it's that, that people really should know. I mean, I know that for whatever reason, when you got in the headspace of the Invasion thing, it was all that just, you know, blitzkrieg shit. That's what you really loved to do. Mm-hmm. And the whammy bar stuff was big back then and all that. But it was just always the over-the-top, over-the-top. But man, he could play anything. Man. He had no, like in his mind, I guess he didn't see how like a bluesier, Jeff Beck type, you know, some of that shit he could do. And of course, the country stuff. I mean, he could, you know, he could do jazz, chordal stuff.
Yeah,
he could do unlimited vocal. He would do this thing also where he could make it. The guitar was like a clavinet.
Yeah,
like those funk, you know, keyboard. Because he played with Edgar Winter for a while. You know, so he could do, you know, so he could. He was really a great musician. We always say was like the guy's dead. You know, right. It's so bizarre. You know, So to your point, that was one of the solos where I think he, you know, I mean, that's so full of shit. I mean, it's a killer solo.
Yeah, it's emotion. I mean, where you're used to him just blistering your ears with his solos. I mean, it's got a groove to it. It's slowed way down. It's a beautiful piece of music, playing on a guitar. It really is.
And I've heard stories about when you guys toured with Maiden, like the Maiden guys would hang out in his dressing room and just listen to him play old Jeff Beck stuff.
Right, right.
And they were just like, why aren't you playing that stuff?
What would he say? Because it's too easy?
He'd say it because it's easy to play. Because I could play faster than that. So,
right.
But back then, it was
seems like a blessing and a curse. You know, to be like that. Where you got the skills to be able to do it, but the curse to not be able to stop.
Right.
Well, and then Naughty Naughty is next. And were you guys upset that Danger had a big hit with a song of the same title?
I don't remember us being too upset. I don't even recall which one came out first.
Yours came out first. I'm just busting balls.
That's right, huh?
Yeah. That was their big first single.
Right, I remember that. Yeah, I'm sure we probably
and then they had a few jokes about it. And they all kinds of songs.
Cherry. Danger, danger. Danger. What are you going to do?
Burn is a pretty awesome rock song.
Talk about blistering guitar on that one.
Yeah.
And that's another thing too with this album, you know, a lot of times you get a guy who's a guitar virtuoso, you know, say like an Yngwie Malmsteen or something where it's like a guitar solo with a song kind of structured around it. This album's different than that because the guitar playing is as blistering as some of this stuff is, it still really fits the song. And the drumming on this whole album, holy shit, you know, the drum sound and the power, you don't expect it out of a band like this and an album like this where the guitar is so powerful and up front.
Drive it.
so far, so good, man. I told you Bobby Rock was the coolest. Before we get back into that conversation with him, and we're having so much fun already, I want to let you guys know, of course, there's more cool stuff over there just waiting for you at HK Collectibles, Inc. This week, it includes a ticket to Kiss's appearance in Lakeland, Florida on the Creatures of the Night Tour. That's historic right there.
Vinnie Vincent.
Really historic show, yes. Vinnie Vincent. Ticket price, $9.75.
That sounds about worth it to me to see the Tank stage.
Good Lord, yeah. Awesome. Also over at HK Collectibles, Inc., you can get a ticket from Kiss's Hot in the Shade Tour with Slaughter opening in Pittsburgh. All that and a ton more. Just head on over to DecibelGeek.com. Click on that HK Collectibles, Inc. banner and do your shopping. Do it today. Now, when you're at DecibelGeek.com, you're going to find our Amazon banner right below it. And, you know, what that means is it's a great way for you to help out the show. You do your shopping on Amazon anyway, I'm sure. So what's it take? An extra couple of seconds to go on over to DecibelGeek.com, click on our banner, and what it does is takes you to Amazon. You do all your shopping just like you normally would, except what happens when you're all done, Amazon takes a cut of their side of it. Not your money, because you're not paying anything extra, but what they do is they take a piece of that that's theirs, and they give it over to us because we sent you through our link to go do your shopping. Simple, easy. I don't think I need to say too much more about it than that.
No.
Except.
Yeah, the one more thing.
The list. Yeah, we get the list every single week that tells us what's been bought through our Decibel Geek Amazon link. Doesn't say who bought what.
No.
We're okay with that. We just want to know what you bought, and it's very cool. A lot of cool stuff. What do we got this time?
Yeah, you guys have been cool about buying stuff through the link. Some of the notable purchases this week include a Canon ink cartridge set, which, you know, that seems kind of ho-hum, but those are not cheap.
We just talked about that. Throw away the printer or when you run out of ink and just go buy a new printer.
Yeah.
No, somebody spent the big bucks through our link to actually buy the cartridges.
Also, some gamer stuff. Nintendo Selects Nintendo Dogs and Cats, Golden Retriever, and New Friends for the Nintendo 3DS. Sounds cool. I don't know what it is, but
okay.
Sounds cool. And then this is cool. A Dragon's Lair game download. Do you remember Dragon's Lair?
Shoot, yeah, I do. It was like a video game that was also a cartoon, right?
Yeah, it was one of the most realistic looking video games at the time in the 80s.
And one of the hardest games to play,
really
too.
Hard.
Yeah.
But this is like a version of it you can download to play on your computer, and it's like high definition video and everything.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. I might have to check that out
myself.
Yeah,
me too. That sounds awesome.
In DVDs, Rolling Stones from the Vault LA Forum in 1975 was bought.
Right on.
I wish Kiss would do that. Rolling Stones do these From the Vault things. They just release live concerts.
High quality.
Yeah, high def or highest quality you can get for the old stuff.
There should definitely be a Kiss From the Vault.
I would buy so much of that stuff.
Oh, no kidding.
And then in music, a band called Pain of Salvation in the Passing Light of Day was bought.
Hmm.
I don't know who that is, but they've been around for a long time, apparently. American Bombshell No Regrets was bought. That was I've heard some good things about that. That had a good review on our website.
Yeah. I'll check into that.
Also, Neil Morse, The Similitude of a Dream.
Okay.
And Suicidal Tendencies, The Art of Rebellion.
Ah, I told you Suicidal Tendencies was awesome.
That album is, yeah.
Yeah, that sure is. That's one of my all-time favorites right there, The Art
like
of
that
Rebellion.
One.
That's a fantastic album.
Yep.
Well, okay. I guess before we get back into our conversation with Bobby Rock, you tell me you got something you really need to get off your chest.
Well, all right. Well, I know some of you guys listening are real, real big Vinnie fans and know this album inside and out.
I find it humorous that you have to break this down and explain it because you are looking at this from their perspective completely.
Well, because I'm in their camp. But,
right.
All right.
You're of their ilk.
Understand that when we talked to Bobby, I was tired. And also, it was a thing where I've got notes in front of me and all, but at the same time, you want to have a good conversation and not be looking down at your notes all the time.
Right.
So, some things got omitted that I should have brought up about the album.
See, this is where I get to skate free because nobody expects me to remember all that stuff. But when it comes to Vinnie Vincent, poor Chris.
And
poor Chris.
I was real absent-minded this day, so we haven't gotten to it yet, but the song Ecstasy did not get mentioned in the track-by-track discussion.
Right, because with this, I think the conversation
kind of went all over the place.
Yeah, a little bit all over the place, maybe not concentrated track-by-track as much as we usually do.
It's more of that era than the track-by-track.
Yeah.
And then...
But we do it.
And then I dropped the ball on this, because the track listing I did, for some reason, the track listing I had in my notes was like the vinyl track listing.
Like the original
track listing. And I had forgotten to mention the Meltdown in Bobby Rock instrumental. And you know I'm pretty shot the Vinnie instrumental at the end. Those are on the CD versions.
Look at you getting all bent out of shape about not covering the bonus tracks off the Japanese CD. Well,
no, those are on the regular one. But it bums the hell out of me that I forgot to. So I apologize to you Vinnie fans. But there's still a lot of cool stuff that's about to be revealed through the episode.
You have so much heart for Vinnie Vincent.
And for Bobby Rock. Because I felt bad. Because like one of the things was his drum solo, and I forgot to mention.
Right, yeah.
And I've been in contact with Bobby by text and up until this evening, and he's real busy right now, but he's going to get me his thoughts either through text or through email, and I will update you guys next week on the show.
I wonder what he must think.
He's probably like, this guy's a complete nut. Who cares?
Who cares about the bonus tracks? Just get to the episode.
But I know you guys do. That's why I'm talking about it.
All right, then. So if you're ready, I'm ready. Let's get back to it. Albums Unleashed, All Systems Go with Bobby Rock on the Decibel Geek Podcast.
But you have found a way to totally just own this album. My father-in-law is a drummer, and he was telling me, you know, really listen to that second Vinnie Vincent Invasion album, and nobody pays attention to the drums, but you really can't not pay attention to the drums, even with everything else going on in it. And the drums on this album, I just got to say, you know, yeah, Vinnie Vincent plays guitar on it, but this is really, truly, at its core, an awesome drum album.
Cool, appreciate that, man.
Well, and it didn't seem like he was wanting to minimize the other guys in the band. It seemed like he wanted everyone to be completely shining on
the
Even
on the first record, that was a big thing. You know, he was always about, you know, more, more, faster, faster, louder, louder. You know, I mean, he liked those real big, showy, you know, flamboyant, chopsy fills.
Yeah.
With the, you know, when you're grooving, it's got to sound real mechanical, but then you can do all the crazy, you know, fills on it. So he liked all that, man.
Yeah.
And we all, live, I'd always get a drum solo spot. I mean, he was really big on all that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it goes to show when he goes through all that effort of the craziness he put you through to record them drums, obviously he cares.
Yeah. For sure.
Let Freedom Rock, we talked a little bit about the origin of it, but that's a great song, and the drum parts on that are pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Too.
Pretty cool, yeah.
And did that one go over pretty well live when you guys would play that one?
That was you know, made for the arena, you know.
Yeah.
That tune, for sure, you know.
I like that song a lot. That Time of Year, maybe my favorite song on the record. And I know it's a ballady tune, but, you know, there's hair metal ballads that were much bigger than this, but I think it eclipses most of them, because it's just a really well-written song all the way around. Did Vinny write that song all on his own?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Yeah. We'll be right back. incredible song.
I mean, for a ballad of that time, you know, to really be something, it's got to be emotional and it's got to strike a chord in you. And around this time, a lot of them ballads just seemed like they were cookie cutter.
Kind of token, yeah.
Right.
Song, like, our third video. Or, yeah.
Right, right. Like you had to have it. But, you know, that song there, man, it's got some heavy, heavy emotion. Just its song so, yeah. drips with it. Yeah. Totally does.
And really beautiful girl in the video, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So. Well, the video for that song is pretty interesting to see because you guys definitely toned down your look for that video. You know, you got much more. Was that intentional?
Or, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
It's all, you know,
it was all intentional.
You know, back then, you're just chasing trends. I mean, yeah. when the thing was put together, you know, the Poison, Motley Crue, glam thing was what was happening.
Yeah.
So that was like, that was the impetus for, let's do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then somewhere between the first and second record, Guns N' Roses came out, so it became more street, you know, denim, more of that kind yeah. of vibe. Mm-hmm. So everybody, you know, backed it down a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
And that's all that was. It was just looking around what everybody else was doing and trying to follow fit. Suit a little bit, trying
sure.
to, you know, do that thing.
Did you enjoy that look bands. More than the first album?
Or
did you like the glammy stuff that you guys did on the first one?
The glam, it was just so outrageous,
yeah.
you know. That's probably more fun. And we would, you know, like we'd go to the mall wearing that shit. We'd be in fucking Nebraska or something, just, you know, with those long earrings and shit.
I can only imagine.
Just what you did. You didn't
the reactions.
Think, you know.
Yeah.
How do we not get fist fights every time we went out in public?
You know,
but you
wonder.
Just didn't. It was you know.
Everybody's standing there going, wow.
I've seen like some people's personal photographs from like meet and greets you guys would do at record stores at malls.
Yeah.
And I'm like, God, they look like men from Mars or something. It's just,
I mean,
so
full
different.
Makeup, fucking
yeah.
the shit on the cheeks. I
yeah.
mean, everything, man. It was what you didn't think twice about it, you know?
Spent a lot of time in a mirror back then.
We did, man.
Yeah.
Man. And then what do you remember about recording Heavy Petting?
I remember Dana having me simplify a particular subtle part of that. That's the main thing that jumps out when he said
yeah.
that. And he, you know, he was, you know, Vinny would be in the room, but Dana would be in my ears, and we'd, you know, navigate through the tracks that way, you know.
Yeah.
That tune has a nice pocket to it.
Yeah.
And I just remember I was trying to do something. I had more notes than I needed. He goes, hey, just it'll sound meaner. That's what he said. It'll sound meaner if you just do kick, snare, and then hit the cymbal, that kind of thing.
Right.
And he was right. You know?
Okay.
Right on.
And Deeper and Deeper.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, the track by track thing, I remember I have little
pieces,
flashbacks
yeah.
about certain things like that, you know?
Yeah.
That one there has this really, really. A moment where both of us, where Vinny, I really go off, I think before the last chorus.
Yeah.
This really killer double bass type thing when he does like this whammy bar lick, you know.
We'll be right back.
lot of killer guitar stuff on that record.
Yeah, yeah, there, there is.
At least, you know.
And then you end it with Breakout, which is a great ender, but certainly not on as crazy of a note as the first album ending.
Twisted or
no, Invasion.
Oh, Invasion, yeah, with that repeated thing.
You've got the
thing,
alarm,
right,
going off for like 5 minutes.
I know, man.
I know we're not talking about that record, but what was that? What was that about?
Who knows? And you know that thing. Wasn't that thing on the record? Hey,
tell your friends about it.
You know what that vibe was all about?
I think Mark told us about it, but I can't.
It was supposed to be backwards.
Oh, it was.
The whole idea of doing it was to have it played backwards.
Uh-huh.
So it was like, whatever it's going to sound like. And then when people would figure out, you know, hey, tell your friends. Oh, clever.
Yeah.
But they just put it on there like, what the fuck is this?
Oh, so they didn't get the memo, huh?
Tell your friends. Yeah, it's like, how the fuck does this, how is communication, where did that get botched in the process there, you know?
It's like, y'all ruined it.
It's funny, I didn't think about that, but yeah. That's...
After all that shit, too.
Yeah.
After all that, the novelty of having that shit spin out or whatever for however many minutes that was.
Right. Know? Oh, jeez.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you remember who was saying, hey, tell your friends about it?
George Suet.
Oh, it was George.
And he recorded it like, if you listen very carefully, you'll hear some like background. Like he was like at a, like a Circuit City or one of these, you know.
Electronic store.
Yeah, electronic store. And it was like some kind of like a digital record. Like he literally went into the place and, you know, and like did it on the fly.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what he used. It was a cassette or what it was.
Right.
But he actually just went out and ghettoed together, you know, just this quick little, hey, tell your brother, like that, and then set the thing. And it was just the most ridiculous thing ever, man, you know.
That was his idea.
Somebody's, I don't know if it's.
It sounds like
when marketing goes wrong.
That now he's. Have you talked to him?
It's been a while.
I would love to interview him, but I've talked to him once on Twitter, and he was just like, "Thanks for offering, but I don't talk about those days."
Right.
He seems to be happy not being involved at all anymore.
Right.
But he's got quite a story to tell, I'm sure. You know.
Oh yeah.
Because he was with Kiss before you guys,
of course.
He managed Ace and he managed Peter.
Yeah.
So yeah, as a Kiss fan, I would love to pick his brain.
Oh yeah.
But did you enjoy having him as a manager?
Yeah, I always liked George. You know, it's, you know, when things don't turn out the way everybody wanted to. Like everybody thought that it was the first record to go platinum. You know, that was the expectation. You know, and when things don't go the way that you wanted them to, the buck has to stop with somebody. It can never be about, well, look, this is how much of an audience we were able to accumulate on it. This is how many sales they were organically. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? Mm-hmm. It was because somewhere along the way, somebody didn't do something.
Right.
So what is it? Management, label, you know, the publicity, like somewhere along the way, somebody's got to take the heat. You know,
right.
So I think because George was always East Coast based, he was always kind of, he wasn't always in the middle of the day-to-day thing. He was always, you know, back east on the other end of the phone kind of thing. Now, he was working the label back in New York. That was a big thing. But we were really signed out of L.A.
Yeah.
So I think there was often issues about, well, management should have done X, Y, and Z. Or how come our manager isn't doing this? Or how come our manager isn't... Now, he would have his own story. Well, I tried that. We did this. You know, so that's the subjective nature of the retrospective view on why something fucked up or didn't go like you wanted it to, you know.
Right. I gotcha. Okay.
Somebody's head's got to be on that.
Right.
Except for the band.
Right.
The band.
You need the band.
But we made the perfect record, so it's always somebody else's.
Right.
You need the band. You can't fire the label.
That's right.
Although, you know, this is repeating one of those mystery posters on message boards who like to always claim it was the fastest selling debut album on Chrysalis Records. Does that sound familiar to you?
Oh, yeah. That was a big buzzword. That was a big thing. And, you know, there's probably some stats to support that.
Oh,
maybe
sure.
1 week it was, you know, it outsold a Pat Benatar or Jethro Tull or whatever. It was, I'm sure, you know.
It broke out of the gates fast.
Right.
But it just didn't quite peak from there. But,
right.
But, I mean, when you look back at that era, and then, of course, you know, everything starts falling apart with the tour and everything, but you know, when you guys finished the album, how confident were you in it at the time? I mean, did you think this is going to be
a double platinum?
Yeah.
There was a big at the record release thing internally. Jeff Aldridge, who was the guy that originally signed Vinny, stands up and does this big toast. 2 million. We're going to do 2 million. That was just what we, you know. At least a mil, but probably two. That was the expectation going in, you know.
Wow.
Hmm.
Wow. That was at the listening party?
Well, that was a private thing. It was like maybe where we played the record for all the like internally, like all the Chrysalis suits showed up to listen, you know, like here it is, everybody, that kind of thing, you know.
Do you think Chrysalis pushed you guys the right way, or do you think they didn't push you enough?
Well, this is where you get into the subjective nature of it. They would always say that, you know, there were issues that where radio didn't want to play it, radio didn't see a big enough song, right? Yeah, they would have their thing about it. I think it's probably fair to say that, you know, Chrysalis wasn't at that time the best hard rock label, you know, that wasn't necessarily their forte.
Right.
But the shit shifted between All Systems Go and the first Slaughter record. Everything shifted over there.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if it was because the existing folks got more on board with Slaughter, or maybe there were a few personnel changes to push it.
Yeah.
And it, you know, or maybe because that was so radio friendly that it was more in their wheelhouse. I'm not sure exactly, but I just remember talking to Mark right around the release time of their first record, and him saying like, "Man, you wouldn't believe it. It's like the label's like night and day from when it was with Vinny. We walk in over there, everybody's cool. The vibe is different, the effort is different, everything they're doing is, you know, it was like a whole different label.
Right.
By the time Stick It To You, you know, came around,
and they tried to keep you as drummer, didn't they?
That was the plan. It was just assumed I was supposed to stay on board with Mark and Dana to do it, you know. And you know, after the fucking PTSD, you know, experience of you know, getting through the tour and all that, I mean, I think, you know, the way most of the tour went down is there were three camps in a sense. There was Vinny, there was Mark and Dana, and I was kind of like neutral. I was kind of like on the fence.
Yeah.
I mean, even towards the end of the tour, there was talk of me staying with Vinny possibly to do his next record, getting another bass player and all that, you know. And
must have felt pulled in both directions.
I did, and so that's why I just kind of did this, you know. And then when we got off the road, I remember I just need to take a few days off. I went to Santa Barbara, you know, north of LA, and just kicked it for a few days by the water, and I just felt like at that time I just needed to kind of separate myself, you know. I mean, I didn't have any real issues. I mean, the Vinny thing was where most of the conflict was coming from.
Sure.
Mark and Dana were cool. We were always cool. I just felt like, you know, man, I just need to jump out and just do something different, basically.
Yeah, get
and
away that was, from this that was, environment.
That's what I felt like at the time, you know.
Are you still happy with that decision?
Or
do you wish you had stuck with those other guys?
You know, that's a philosophical question. I think if I were to answer it strictly from a business perspective, a career perspective, I would have been better off staying with Mark and Dana. You know, knowing then what I know now, and you know, all things considered,
right.
I think that was more, you know, what they wound up doing was more in the trajectory of where my fan base was.
Yeah.
Musically, I think the Nelson thing, there's arguments you can make about, you know, against doing that or whatever.
I was very successful too.
Sure.
Yeah.
And with the Slaughter thing, it would have been, quite frankly, a much better and smarter business decision, because I would have been an equity member. You know.
Yeah, that's true.
The band guys there made a lot more than the band guys in Nelson. I'll just leave it at that. You know. Yeah. So it would have. So from that perspective, but if you're asking me if I could go back in time and make a different decision, the answer is no.
Yeah.
Because again, philosophically, you know, if one little change like that, like do I take, you know, do I go this way or that way? I mean, each one leads to a whole different life experience, people you meet. Mm-hmm. You know, like we wouldn't be sitting here talking right now. Like everything would, you know, everything that happens after is somehow related to, you know.
Yeah, it changes it all.
It changes everything. And I wouldn't want to, you know, if a leprechaun said, okay, listen, you can go back right now. And I go, you know, but now, you know, my iPhone would have a whole different bunch of names in it.
Sure. Yeah,
and I wouldn't want to, you know, that's the trade-off. You
go. Yeah. Mess up the timeline, yes, man.
Don't mess up the timeline.
And I would, and the Nelson, I mean, there was a lot of great things about that, and those guys, and that experience. That
was a solid gig for a long time.
It was a different vibe, you know. Yeah. But I would, you know, it was different enough to where I don't know any other gig like that. That had some of the rock elements, but then had that kind of boy band, crazy girls running down the hallway of the hotel every night and all that shit. I mean, there was something a little more fanatical about that.
Oh, really?
That I wouldn't want to miss out on, quite frankly.
Sure.
You know, the life experience, you know, that combining, you know, so...
like you said, also, I think it was a mental health break you probably needed
that. There's no question. Yeah. So I can't second guess that either, you know.
Because I got to think even Mark and Dana were probably burned.
They were fried. Everybody was fried. We walked away from that thing, you know.
Yeah. I just hate that it had to end on such a sour note.
I guess most bands do.
That's just the way it is.
Tell me about it.
Because you guys, I mean, for two records, you guys were really awesome. You know, I hate that there wasn't more out of that.
Right.
And did you ever cross paths with Vinny after that?
A couple phone conversations.
Yeah.
The last time I talked to Vinny was probably late 1992.
Wow, it's been a while.
That was it, man. That was it. And you just no other contact beyond that.
This is amazing.
Yeah.
Because was there talk at the time of bringing you back in to play or?
It was something that was thrown around. I talked to Nigel about it. It was something that was mentioned somewhere along the way. You know, like as a possibility. Vinny was looking at other bass players and all that. Meanwhile, Mark and Dan, I was talking to so I was kind of really in the middle. But as we got. Like the last couple weeks of the thing, it went south so fast that I'm sure on both sides it was off the table. Like at that point I was not even considering it, and they probably weren't either. You know, just the way the money and the way all of the shit happened, and it got bad in a hurry. You know, the last week, I mean, it was
just ugly.
Torturous, man. Yeah.
Mm. See, and then you go on to play with Nelson, but I always have kind of wondered, you know, with you being such a powerful drummer and your style. Would you ever picture yourself being in like a thrash metal band?
Nah, the thrash thing never was my vibe. I mean, that's a different kind of thing. I respect that style and that drumming and all that with all the double bass shit and all that. You know, but I'm more of a heavy pocket.
Right.
Now, I like to do the crazy shit too, but I like you know more of the even like with what we do with Lita. You know, nowadays just that pocket playing, heavy groove and all that.
We saw you in soundcheck, man. The drum set back there's probably still bitching. He's laying it in.
Yeah, man.
Boom.
But yeah, so let's bring it up to today. You're now playing with Lita Ford. How long have you been playing with her?
4 years now.
4 years.
Yeah.
Right on.
It's been a pretty fun gig for you.
It's been great, man. Yeah. We have a good time. Yeah.
And she's got a hell of a catalog to.
She really does. Yeah, man. She's a fucking icon, man. I mean, it's a great gig. She's a really good player. It's a killer band. We have a good time. You know, it's a good setup, right? A good situation right now.
Drummer's pretty good.
Sorry?
Drummer's pretty good.
He does okay. He holds his own,
cool. Right on. Very cool.
Well, I want to thank you for doing this, and it's been a real honor to sit there and talk to you and get your memories on
album
you made so many years ago. But, I mean, have you got to go back and listen to either of the albums?
Much? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I got them on my Spotify.
Yeah.
I have my the vinyl and all that shit, of course, all the records. But, I mean... To me, it always gets down to the songs.
Yeah,
right.
You know, I mean, you can listen to the chops and the great playing and all that. And I love Vinny's playing, man.
Yeah.
Even on the first record, you know, you put on the headphones.
Yeah.
You crank that shit up. You know, like I said, it's my go-to record if you just really want to get your head taken off.
That's what
with some over-the-top guitar playing and cool arena riffs and all that.
That it is.
But the songs, man, still on both of those records still really hold up. And
that's, they do.
And over time, that always tells the story. You know.
Yeah.
It's always about the songs. And that motherfucker could write some songs, and I'll to this day I'll be at the gym sometimes, and I'll check out All Systems. You know, it's still fun to listen to. You know,
that's cool.
So,
if the planets aligned and Vinnie Vincent and Mark and Dana were able to put it all aside and do it, would you be interested in reuniting with Vinnie Vincent?
Yeah, I would. You know, the only X factor is just to kind of know, you know. Frankly, where his head is at these days.
Right.
You know, is he still interested in playing? Is he still, you know, I could probably figure it out in 2 or 3 minutes of just talking with him, you know.
Right.
But the answer is yes, man. Why not? You know,
it'd be awesome.
We got to play.
I know a lot of people would love to see it.
Yeah. It's an ambitious thought. I mean, to kind of pull everybody together to do it or whatever.
Right.
But if the planets aligned, man, I'd be up for it. It'd be fun, you know.
That'd be cool. Oh, man, that'd be cool.
All right, well, if you're listening, he's available. So. Okay, so thanks for doing this,
man. You got it, man. Thank you, guys.
Right. Awesome.
Very cool.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.